back to Archaeology News Weekly. I am David Connolly, a rather exhausted archaeologist after working all day out in the field. This is great stuff. I can't actually tell you what and where I am just now, but all I can tell you is it is amazing archaeology. It's really good to work with people who have a real passion for the subject and realise just how important it is. Anyway, enough about myself. Let's get on with the news. This news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. All the stories have been collected from various sources, and to view details in each story, of course, including the source, see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. Well, we've got prehistoric finds in Ontario, and then the word is that there's no evidence for the Clovis catastrophe. The Stonehenge boy with a necklace was from the Mediterranean, and prehistoric remains are found in Jakarta. A unique Bronze Age burial chamber is excavated in Scotland, and excavations begin on submerged Welsh village, which will be staying underwater. I've got a bit of a problem here, unfortunately, because I have been at the dentist and I've still got rather a numb tongue. Anyway, staying underwater, an Irish fish trap may date back to the Mesolithic. There's news of an extraordinary settlement found in India, as well as a 7,000-year-old village discovered in Bulgaria. Not to be outdone, though, we've got a Neolithic settlement unearthed in Hungary, and keeping it going, we've got a prehistoric settlement on the Mississippi. There's a battle to save the Louisiana State University mounds, and we end up with the famous Legend Rock petroglyphs, which are dated to the end of the Pleistocene. So, to begin our news today, archaeologists have discovered a series of ancient finds in Cayuga in Ontario, Canada. In 2008, a preliminary design study was completed and recommended replacing the Highway 3 Grand River Bridge. An archaeological assessment during the preliminary design study confirmed that the west side of the bridge is a prehistoric and historic archaeological site. As part of the project to replace the bridge, an archaeological salvage operation was required to complete the excavation and retrieval of artifacts before construction work began. Monica Fleck of the Ministry of Transportation's West Region noted that one particular interesting prehistoric find was a complete ceramic pot, or in fact many ceramic pots of small sizes, presumably the result of a young child being taught how to make pottery, possibly thousands of years ago in fact. She feels that this is a very significant archaeological site, and based on previous studies, the artifacts range in age from the Archaic period, which is around 8,000 to 1,000 BCE, through to the Historic period. The current salvage work has been delayed somewhat by periodic floodings over the summer, but it's expected the excavation will continue again next spring and probably be completed by mid-summer. Once the excavation is complete, the artifacts will be removed from the site and taken to a lab where they will be fully analysed. A new study published in Current Anthropology challenges the controversial theory that the impact of an ancient comet devastated the Clovis people, one of the earliest known cultures to inhabit North America. Well, Vance T. Holliday, a professor in the University of Arizona School of Anthropology and the Department of Geosciences, and David Meltzer, an archaeologist at Southern Methodist University, studied evidence from a number of archaeological sites and concluded that it was more likely that hunting populations shifted their subsistence patterns to hunting other animals. The comet theory first emerged in 2007, I remember it well, when a team of scientists announced the evidence of a large extraterrestrial impact that occurred around 12,900 years ago. The impact was said to have caused a sudden cooling of the North American climate, killing off the mammoths and other megafauna. It would also explain the apparent disappearance of the Clovis people, whose characteristic spear points vanished from the archaeological record shortly after the supposed impact. As evidence for the rapid Clovis depopulation, comet theorists point out that the very few Clovis archaeological sites show evidence of human occupation after Clovis. At the few sites that do, Clovis and post-Clovis artifacts are separated by archaeological sterile layers of sediments, indicating about a 500-year time gap between these civilizations. But Meltzer and Holliday dispute the claims. They argue that a lack of later human occupation at Clovis sites is no reason to assume a population collapse. They argue that single occupation Paleo Indian sites, Clovis or post Clovis, are in fact the norm, because many Paleo Indian sites are hunting kill sites, and it would be highly unlikely for kills to be made repeatedly in exactly the same spot. Good point there. Meltzer says he would be surprised if these sites were occupied repeatedly. In addition, Holliday and Meltzer compiled radiocarbon dates of 44 archaeological sites from across the US and found absolutely no evidence of post-comet gap. Their findings show chronological gaps appearing in the sequence only if one ignores standard deviations, a statistically inappropriate procedure. And doing so creates gaps not just around 12,900 years ago, but also at many later points in time. Shifting settlement pattern and local geological processes easily explain sterile layers separating occupation zones at some sites. Holliday and Meltzer believe that the disappearance of the Clovis spear points is more likely to result as a result of a cultural choice rather than a population collapse. They conclude that there's no compelling data to indicate that North American Paleo-Indians had to cope with or were affected by a catastrophe, extraterrestrial or otherwise. Whether or not the proposed extraterrestrial impact occurred is a matter for empirical testing in the geological record. Insofar as it concerns the archaeological record, an extraterrestrial impact is an unnecessary solution for an archaeological problem that does not exist. In fact, I was actually talking about, well, not this, but the need to actually have the simple solution. Occam's razor should be in the toolkit of every archaeologist. Anyway, Stonehenge is once again giving up more information as a result of teeth. Yes, teeth. In 2005, excavation for road construction 5 kilometres from Stonehenge unearthed the complete skeleton of a teenage boy. He was lying on his side and wore a unique necklace of 90 amber beads. Now, isotope studies of his teeth have indicated that he grew up in the region around the Mediterranean. Dental enamel in teeth retains a trace of the isotope ratio of oxygen present in the drinking water consumed during childhood. Strontium isotopes from rocks get into the food supply and can also be measured in teeth. When data from both isotopes are combined, it's possible to actually trace back to the origin of a given region. Archaeologists from the British Geological Survey conducted the excavations along with Wessex Archaeology. Professor Jane Evans, the head of the organisation, describes the boy as around 14 or 15 years old, and he's buried with a beautiful necklace. The position of his burial, the fact that he's near Stonehenge, and the necklace all suggest he is of significant status. She notes that during the Bronze Age, burial at Stonehenge would have been akin to the modern burials at Westminster Abbey. Dr. Andrew Fitzpatrick of Wessex Archaeology supports her conclusions about the high status of the boy, as amber necklaces are not common finds. People who can get these rare and exotic materials are most likely people of some importance. Another skeleton found earlier in the Stonehenge area was also tested with isotope studies of the teeth. That individual was found to have come from a colder climate, perhaps in the mountains of what is now Germany. Known as the Amesbury Archer, he carried some of the oldest gold and copper objects found to date in Britain. His remains were dated to around 4,300 years BPE, so he lived 800 years earlier than the boy. The presence of two people who travelled a great distance to get to Stonehenge could indicate that it was a very well-known landmark for hundreds of years in the Bronze Age. According to Dr. Fitzpatrick, the beginning of the Bronze Age was a period of great mobility across Europe. People, ideas, objects were all moving very fast for a century or two. At the time when the boy with the amber necklace was buried, there are really no new technologies coming into Britain. It's interesting to look at why groups of people, because of this youngster, were making this long journey. Are they travelling with family groups? Or are they coming to visit Stonehenge because it was a famous or important place, as it is today? Unfortunately, of course, we don't know the answer. Well, not yet, anyway. Unless, of course, it was some sort of early form of EasyJet. But hopefully that's not the case. Anyway, we'll now move to Sumatra. Two archaeologists from Medan in North Sumatra have found evidence that a village in the central Aceh district of Indonesia had been inhabited by prehistoric humans. Katut Wirandanya and Lucas Partana Coestro announced that they had found artifacts such as a square stone axe, a niche and pottery pieces, and a human skeleton inside a cave near Danau Laut Tawar, a lake in Kampung Mendale. The skeleton's exact age has not yet been confirmed, since the excavation is still ongoing, but Ketut says the artifacts would have to undergo a carbon dating test at the National Atomic Energy Agency in Bataan. Last May, residents of the Jayapura district of the Papua province found prehistoric remains at two different locations. Hari Soroto, head of the research team from the Archaeological Institute, said that locals who were digging at Kalkot, a small village in the eastern Sentani district, came across pottery, now believed to date back to the Neolithic age, about 1500 BCE in that area. The team also established that the same type of pottery was found in Vanimo in Papua New Guinea in 1996. Hari and Lapita pottery have also been discovered previously in many places in the Pacific region and the Bismarck Islands. Residents of Kodari village in Waibo district found a bronze axe, which the archaeological team said was made around 300 BCE. It originally came from Dong Son in North Vietnam. Instead of entrusting the axe to the Archaeological Institute, the village chieftain kept the axe. Well, bully for him. Although it's a shame that no one outside the village will ever see it. Photos, I suspect, will have to do. But you're not really going to argue with the village chieftain, are you? Next, a unique find in Scotland. A 4,000-year-old burial chamber in Perthshire has been described as Scotland's Valley of the Kings. Excavation of the site at Forteviot began in earnest last year and has been regarded as something of an archaeological jewel. It was uncovered by the Strathairn Environs and Royal Forteviot Project, or SERF for short, run by archaeologists from Glasgow, Aberdeen and Chester universities. And the results of the project, first 3 years, have just been published by Perth and Kinross Heritage Trust. Researchers first discovered the 4-ton capstone slab covering the burial chamber in 2008, but had to wait until last year to organise the resources to lift it. The team had hoped that there was a burial chamber beneath, but had no idea it would prove to be one of the best preserved sites in Britain, almost undamaged by the passage of time. The high quality of preservation proved to be a virtually unique, and archaeologists were soon claiming the early Bronze Age grave as a site of exceptional importance. I have to say, I actually watched the opening of it live on a fabulous sort of video clip, and shall we say the language was rather fruity. It wasn't so much of a case of Carter's "I see many wonderful things," but anyway, if you pop along to YouTube and Google this, you'll see what I mean. Returning to the story, though, at the entrance, a stone sealed the grave so that organic material survived, with a leather bag, unidentified wooden objects, plant matter, and a distinctive bronze dagger with a gold hilt band amongst the items found. The plant matter was later identified as meadowsweet blossoms and was hailed as the first proof that people in the Bronze Age laid flowers on the graves of loved ones. Together with the carvings on the underside of the capstone, the finds were taken as evidence that the grave was that of a significant person. The team returned this year to reveal more impressive burial monuments, indicating that the site was a significant centre of ceremony and burial in the early prehistoric and up into the Pictish periods. Excavations explored part of a massive Neolithic timber enclosure. The monument required over 200 huge timber posts, which would have needed a ramp to hoist them into position. The site continued as a major burial location and ritual landscape into the Bronze Age. There are also square barrow cemeteries from the Pictish period, and although these burial mounds have not yet been dated, their form suggests they are early, demonstrating that people in the Dark Ages were using the prehistoric earthworks as sacred places for burial in a period around the formation of the Pictish kingdom. Perth MSP Rosanna Cunningham said the burial site helped to underline the absolutely central importance of this part of Perthshire to the whole of Scotland. The full story, along with illustrations and photographs, is revealed in the new 60-page Perth and Kinross Heritage Trust publication, the Strathairn Environs and Royal Forteviot Project Report. That's a snappy title. 2006 to 2009. The booklet is available from the Trust's offices. Now, you can get along to their website where I'm sure you will be able to find it there. So pop along to the Perth and Kinross Heritage Trust website where you'll be able to find that publication. Now, from Scotland to Wales, Dr. Andrew Peterson is looking for ancient stone and willow walls off the coast of several Welsh towns. Peterson recently excavated a complete town from the sands of Qatar. He says that Wales and Qatar happen to have some of the best preserved fish traps in the world. They're mostly woven from branches of willow or made of stone, and they look like dry stone walls under the sea. He believes that they date back thousands of years, possibly to prehistoric fishermen, although he's not entirely sure how, when, or why they were built. Well done there, Mr. Dr. Peterson. Anyway, the fish traps that can stretch for miles can be seen underwater now, with some of the best found in the Severn Estuary and at Fishguard in Pembrokeshire. They probably date back to the times when mammoths and sabre-toothed tigers roamed Wales. Well, I very much doubt that. But anyway, fishermen would have likely have caught octopus and cuttlefish in them. Both the Irish Sea and the Arabian Gulf are shallow seas, so a large amount of their areas would have once been land before the sea levels rose. According to Dr. Martin Bates, who specialises in undersea archaeology at Lampeter University in the UK, the landscapes that were previously dry 6,000 years ago and beyond are buried all under the sea in around Wales. At low tide, you can see evidence of fossil forests off the coasts of Borth and Clarach Bay in West Wales, and drills below the sea level 2 or 3 miles off the coast of Aberoeron have recovered peat deposits and pollen from when the area was developing water marshes. Dr. Bates added that 20,000 years ago, the sea around Wales was 125 metres below its current level, which was established around about 6,000 years ago, when the last of the big game hunters were returning to Britain after the last ice age and moving into the caves in Pembrokeshire and the Gower. 10,000 years ago, the ice melted as the sea levels rose and the temperature warmed to its current level, and there was a switch to the Mesolithic hunters chasing forest animals and marine life. Dr. Bates concluded that those Welsh mobile hunters would have undoubtedly lived in skin tents and huts on the edge of these dense forests near rivers and would have made axes and stone tools. Multi-beam sonar surveys are going to be used to look beneath the sandbanks and see what is under the seabed above the rock that relates to the last ice age. The new science is still in its infancy, and an exciting science it is, and so many coastlines have changed over the years, the finds could be spectacular. Now, staying underwater, archaeologists have discovered a complex series of weirs and dams to trap rare fish on Connemara's Errislanan Peninsula in Ireland, and speculate that they may date back to the Mesolithic period. Local resident John Fallon is still constructing and using these traps for the weir and dam system, modelled on pre-Christian design. He'd been unaware of the historical importance of the equipment and coastal system or the fish species until contacted by archaeologist Michael Gibbons. The National Museum of Ireland has now commissioned John to construct one of his traps for its folk life collection. Mr. Gibbons was walking on the north side of Errislanan outside Clifton when he noticed the stone ponds, channels and dams which link Manan Bay to several inner lagoons. He learned that the system had been designed to enclose and trap a type of fish that frequent the River Barrow called the Marram. The fish is similar to a smelt and may be related to a shad. Neither of these words mean anything to me. I think I'm going to have to pop along and find out what they actually mean. Anyway, Dr. Cillian Roden, a marine biologist, said that the fish type was fascinating, but its identity was uncertain. He felt it was possible that the smelt do live in lagoons, which would make the lagoons very important in environmental terms. Mr. Follin remarked that people depended upon fish for generations, and they would get hundreds of them sometimes, but only during the early spring. Mr. Gibbons said the system, which dates back to Mesolithic times, had been adapted for contemporary use over the centuries and shows how rich Ireland's coastline is in historical terms, both in maritime history and archaeology. Well, now we have an extraordinary settlement find in India. A large number of stone tools and weapons said to date back more than 80,000 years were unearthed from a dry lake bed in, I'm going to hate trying to tell you this, Singhanadivakkam in Tamil Nadu in India. Located in a remote hamlet only a couple of weeks ago, the cache could signal a major find in the area. It was part of an ongoing excavation that's partly funded by the Archaeological Survey of India. The artifacts uncovered so far include hand axes, choppers, scrapers and borers, as well as microlithic tools, which are small stone implements, and pointed tools of varying sizes and shapes. Most of the tools could have been used for hunting and fishing. The settlement, as can be gauged from the tools, shows a transition from the early to the middle Paleolithic age. The Professor Pisipati, who's in charge of the excavation, said that the huge number of tools, over 200, found at one in the one-hectare site, indicates that it could have hosted quite a large human settlement. Many of the settlers may have migrated from northern parts of the country. The geoarchaeologist added that this period encompassed the first widespread use of technology as humans progressed from simple to more complex development stages. It is generally said to have begun around 500,000 years ago and ended around about 6,000 BCE with the development of agriculture. Professor Pisipati continued that unlike other similar finds, including the first Paleolithic tool, which was a hand axe discovered at Pallavaram in 1863, this one at Singadevakam is unique for at least one reason. The site had evidence in the form of tools and weapons showing the transition from the Stone Age, this is sort of the early Paleolithic, into the middle Paleolithic. In the rest of the Paleolithic sites discovered so far, there has been a break in the sequence. This makes this site the largest Paleolithic settlement near Chennai. Well, let's move along from the heat of India into Bulgaria. A prehistoric home dating back 7,000 years has been uncovered by a team of archaeologists at Telish in the central northern district of Plevan in Bulgaria. The team, led by archaeologist Ventislav Girgov, is convinced that the home, found in a place known as Laga, is part of a village with at least 30 houses. Our ancient predecessors constructed amazingly robust houses, much more robust than many of the contemporary apartment buildings we can see today, Girgov commented. The walls of the homes were made of stamped clay mixed with cow manure and straw and were additionally supported with wooden poles. This is how the houses became monolithic and acquired an amazing heating insulation. Girgov has found parts of over 40 highly ornate ceramic vessels inside the house, as well as two clay ovens built one over the other. The excavations of the site will continue for only one more week because of lack of funding. All the finds will then be turned over to the Plevan Regional Historic Museum. That's a shame. There never seems to be enough money for archaeology. A Neolithic settlement has also been unearthed in Hungary. The remains of a 7,000-year-old settlement have been unearthed in southwest Budapest's 22nd district by archaeologists from the Budapest History Museum. During the excavations, the experts have discovered the foundations of six buildings, which originally had clay walls supported by wooden beams. Next to these houses, the archaeologists have found remains of baking ovens, storage pits and waste holes in the ground, yielding a rich collection of broken clay vessels and stone tools from the linear pottery culture. Now, over to the good old US of A. A team of archaeologists from the Science Museum of Minnesota uncovered more evidence this summer of prehistoric settlements at a park near Hastings in Minnesota. In the 1950s, a local boy called Ken Klink piqued the curiosity of archaeologists when he began showing them artifacts he had collected in the area. The Science Museum excavated and documented a number of sites, but never fully completed work on one parcel known as Renelius Site. A collection of artifacts was preserved by the museum, but that was it. Team leader Ed Fleming said that they'd always wondered about the Renelius Site, and so in July, with grant funding from the Legacy Amendment, they went to check it out again. The project was relatively small and specifically targeted. The team first used high-tech equipment to check for varying characteristics of the soil to pinpoint locations that could yield artifacts, or perhaps ground conditions that may have indicated a fire pit or a structure. One spot they identified turned out to be a fire pit. They now have a bag of charred rock and burnt animal bones, which is evidence that whoever was there ate, well, wait for it, large mammals. Although Fleming noted that it was also crushed up, so it wasn't really identifiable. To the 1950s collection, already in the Science Museum, they also added stone flakes, evidence of tool-making and projectile points. They also found pieces of pottery, but one thing that they didn't find was evidence of permanent housing. That leads Fleming and other archaeologists to believe that the Spring Lake area may have been more of a temporary campsite than a village. But the area is large and there are more places to explore. For now, park visitors can get a taste of the prehistoric settlements at the park, believed to stretch back 8,000 years, in interpretive displays at the Shar-Bluff Gathering Centre. Well, if I was in America, I would gather there. Staying in the US, there's a battle to save the Louisiana State University mounds. Football fans have regrettably won the battle for the preservation of Louisiana State University mounds. For now, LSU administrators opted to remove ropes and poles which have been barricading the historic Native American mounds on school grounds for safety reasons. LSU Associate Vice Chancellor for Communications Herb Vincent said fans and children had overcome the barriers the week before the first football game. So rather than enforce the barriers, thereby keeping both children and the mounds safe, the LSU opted just to take them down. This decision came less than 2 weeks after LSU had announced plans to block off what are commonly known as the Indian mounds for preservation purposes on high-traffic football game days. Why the complete turnaround, I wonder? LSU archaeologists and anthropologists who were out protecting the mounds and handing out literature said they felt abandoned by the LSU administration. Rebecca Saunders, archaeology professor and associate curator of the Louisiana State University Museum of Natural Science, said that the preservationists were dumbfounded. The barricades were removed by the university without their knowledge. She never felt there would be such resistance to actually preserving the mounds. Prehistoric American Indian tribes made the mounds, which are more than 6,000 years old, and are believed to have been used for ceremonial and marking point purposes. Rob Mann, Southeast Regional Archaeologist in LSU's Geography and Anthropology Department, said that the repeated sledging and biking on the mounds, especially on tailgating, I have to say I have no idea what that means, weekends, is tearing them down. The mounds are in danger of coming apart, he feels. Mann said that many people obeyed the barricades initially, but that by the afternoon a combination of alcohol consumption and growing crowds created a critical mass that resulted in people just ignoring the ropes. Apparently the tradition of tailgating, and I'm going to have to find out actually exactly what tailgating is, and children playing on the mounds will be hard to change. But he states that it would be nice if people would just think about them as more than just big piles of dirt. Yes, it would be nice. In Louisiana and everywhere else, archaeological sites are threatened. Now, we know that American football can be a bit fanatical, but we'll guess that the mounds at LSU are not the only place that fans can party. Finally, in a bit of better news from the US, a site that's been around for over 10,000 years and still going strong. In the arid plains of Wyoming in the USA, early humans left their mark. Legend Rock, named by the Shoshone Indians who live nearby, towers 200 feet above the valley floor and extends 800 yards across. For 11,000 years, it was a canvas for the native people. Animals and human figures have been chipped into the rock face. Some are tiny, but others are over 5 feet high. The oldest date to approximately 11,000 years BCE. They show an antelope, a human, and an adult human hand. The chipped out rock creates tiny depressions that have collected minerals throughout the millennia. And it's this accumulation that has allowed scientists to date the carvings. The handprint is estimated to be about 10,700 years old, plus or minus 1,400 years. It was thought that the Shoshone had lived in the valley for only a few hundred years prior to the arrival of the Europeans. More recent archaeological and linguistic research has shown that their arrival was thousands of years earlier. The Shoshone, or their predecessors, may have created the rock art. It's played a large part in the ritual and religion of the tribe, who believe that the figures have been carved by spirits who resided within the stone. Legend Rock was made a National Historic Site in 1973. It's a beautiful park to visit if you're ever in the US. For information or some spectacular pictures, why not visit the website at www.wyoparks, that's W-Y-O-P-A-R-K-S, .state.wy.us. Well, that's it for today, and we can only get excited at the approaching event of the year. What's that you say? Well, it's the New Look Past Horizons. Yes, in November, very beginning of November, there's going to be a brand new look to the Past Horizons website and magazine. And to celebrate this, there's going to be some cracking giveaways. So if you want to get involved in this, then pop along to Facebook, type in Past Horizons, and why not become our fans? We'd love to see you there. I have to, of course, remind you, I can't stop myself, of the fabulous Badger website, where you'll be able to find many new, not so many though I have to say now, archaeological and heritage employment opportunities. And remember that all what's more can be found at Stonepages, news.stonepages.com. Well, I made it through to the end, and thank you for listening to Archaeology News Weekly. We hope you'll return again to us next week.